Welcome back to the MAD Podcast, a series of conversations with leaders from across the machine learning, AI, and data landscape with Matt Turk, partner at Firstmark Capital. Today, we are diving into the world of generative AI in healthcare with CEO and co-founder of Hippocratic AI, Munjal Shah. In this episode, Matt and Munjal discuss the vision for Hippocratic AI and the unique challenges and opportunities of deploying generative AI in the world of healthcare. If you are brand new to the MAD Pod, welcome. And if you are a returning listener, welcome back. Regardless of which group you fall into, you are going to want to hit that subscribe or follow button to be the first to know when we release new episodes. And with the guests we have lined up for the next couple months, you are definitely going to want to be following. Now, with that being said, let's get into it. Here are Matt and Munjal.
Munjal, welcome to the MAD Pod. Today, we are going to dive into the fascinating intersection between healthcare and generative AI. So to set it up, you are the co-founder and CEO of Hippocratic AI. Hippocratic AI is a young startup that is building the first safety-focused LLM for healthcare. And we're going to talk extensively about what that means, with an overall mission to increase healthcare access for millions of people around the world via generative AI. While you are a young company, as I mentioned, you've already raised a couple rounds. So I read $50 million in seed, but then more recently, another $15 million tranche, making it a total of 65. So congratulations on your early fundraising success. I'd love to start the conversation maybe with the origin story of the company. As I was prepping for this, you're coming to this very much from the machine learning and AI world. You were the founder, among other things, and other companies of Like.com, which was, I believe, a computer vision company that was acquired by Google. So I'd love to hear your narrative of the journey and how you went from computer vision and AI into the world of healthcare.
Yeah, you know, I am a serial entrepreneur. I love building companies. I love using them to try to make an impact on the world. I'm a computer scientist at heart. You know, I did my undergraduate and graduate work both in CS and in machine learning. As an undergrad, my senior thesis was building a neural network to predict protein ligand binding efficacy for 3D model drugs. You know, I wrote the code to parallelize it on the first multi-node supercomputer, because back then things didn't work so fast, and you didn't have all of the tools you have today. But then I built two companies, one of which was the machine learning company, Like.com, where we use computer vision to search inside of photographs, looking at the color, shape, and pattern of aesthetic items like shoes and handbags, and find you stuff to shop for that looks similar. And we sold that to Google, and I you know, that was my journey up until that point. And then the day after I sold the company, and kind of what should have been one of the best days of my entrepreneurial career, I ended up with chest pains and ended up in the ER. And so I was 37 at the time. My father had his first heart attack in his mid 40s. So my genes weren't exactly the best genes, but I ended up losing 30, 40 pounds. I'm not that tall a person. So that kind of weight's actually pretty significant on me. And then really got into healthcare. Actually took classes in endocrinology and loved it. Said, you know what, the next company I want to build is in healthcare. And then I spent 10 years building a healthcare company, only to realize, man, healthcare is hard. It gets a lot harder than pure tech is. And then, you know, honestly, like so many others, I saw ChatGPT come out, and I said, oh my God, AI finally works. Like, we've all been talking about it. We've all been trying to use it. It's been a bit of what I call an idiot savant till now. It could do one narrow thing well, but if you took it anything outside of that, it just like didn't work. You know, at least traditional classifier AI. And I kind of said, but now there's a real potential. And I said, this is the time. This is kind of what I've been waiting for my whole career, is to combine these two passions of mine and you know, build something like Hippocratic.
Great. So obviously the healthcare field is very wide, and one can think of various applications of AI in general and generative AI in particular. One is clearly the field of drug discovery. Another one would be diagnosis, helping doctors come up with the right call on what may be happening. And then there is the whole world of healthcare management, operations, efficiency, and all the things. You've resolutely decided not to focus on diagnosis. I'd love to hear the rationale why. So if generative AI changes everything, does it not change that and open up the opportunity to diagnosis?
I don't think it's safe enough. I mean, it's really simple in some ways. Like, I think, I don't know why people keep, like, it's like flies to the flame. I mean, they just keep going there. I'm going to do diagnoses because it's grand or it's challenging, but they're going to kill somebody. I'm like, this is really serious. Like, I don't want that to be my legacy. Like, so my view was, you know, and they've not done the math. Healthcare is $4.2 trillion. Let's take all the spend that goes to doctors and take that as a proxy for diagnoses, right? It's not a perfect proxy, but it's a decent proxy. That's only $600 billion. Okay, where's the other $3.6 trillion? Like, let's go solve that. They're like, oh, let's do drug design. I mean, drugs are not that much either, right? So, I mean, they're a big chunk. Maybe I think there's $400 billion, $500 billion. I forgot the exact number, but it's in that range. I'm like, look, there's so much more. There's another $3 trillion that's non-drug, non-diagnoses. Let's go make that part of healthcare work. And it's not like the country is short making the right diagnoses. Our biggest issue in the U.S. and most of the developed world is the people don't follow the directions after they're diagnosed. Like, it's not an issue of diagnoses. It's an issue of adherence. It's an issue of ongoing attention and support. It's an issue of getting the other barriers out of the way that's keeping them from being able to manage their health well. Like, let's go do that. And so I think just most people who build LLMs just did not have enough experience in the healthcare world to understand there are so many other problems to be solved that LLMs can solve. And so they just solve. It's like when you see startups by kids dropping out of college, they're always like, here's how you jump the line at a club. Here's how you find a college roommate. Like, every startup idea is one of those, because that's just what their lived experience is, right? And here it's, you know, and I think that's most people's lived experience if they didn't work in healthcare, but they just were consumers of healthcare. And so those are the ideas that they think of. Now, you know, it's fine by me. I'm more than happy. I'm like, hey, all of you, keep trying to do diagnoses. Keep trying to work on that. Like, but I'm going to go do this other thing over here.
Great. So that narrows it down by quite a bit. But obviously, in the $3+ trillion that's left, there's a lot of things. And, bearing in mind for anybody listening to this that Hippocratic is pre-launch. You just looking at the website, you cover a broad range of things that go from healthcare administration and helping people just process operations faster to having dietitians involved. So what is the space you're operating in and the general problem set that you're looking to solve with LLMs?
Yeah, you know, I lay out three different kind of uses of LLMs to impact healthcare, you know, and that's why I call it a healthcare LLM, because healthcare is broader than just diagnoses, right? It's all the things going. But there's three use cases. First, let's call it productivity in workflow. That means you're in the electronic medical record, you're helping the doctor right there answer a communication from a patient, something called the in-basket, which is kind of their equivalent of an inbox effectively. Or a doctor writing a note to an insurance company to escalate. A lot of people have come up with these ideas. They're interesting. They're helpful. They're actually probably better suited for the people who sell those software systems today to build in. But they don't change healthcare that much. They maybe make you 5% more efficient, 10% more efficient. It's not clear if you make somebody 10% more efficient that they see 10% more patients, right? In fact, if they're right now spending every evening answering their in-basket, which most doctors are, and that's time they would rather have spent with their kids. When they get that 10% back from that time, they spend it with their kids, rightfully so. But that means the system didn't get any efficiency. That means we didn't see more patients. And that's, you know, that's what happens. The second use case is healthcare has a massive staffing problem. Most people don't know this, but in the pandemic, a lot of healthcare workers quit. They just got burned out. It was just too much. And they quit. And so in the country today, we're 20%, 30% understaffed in like nurses alone. This isn't just true in the US. This is true in every single country out there. You look at the wait times in some areas of Montreal to get a primary care physician, they're like 3 years in Canada. The wait times in the UK are also significantly long. So then we said, hey, look, let's what if we could use LLMs, add voice to them, and have them call patients in a virtual care setting and do a bunch of tasks in an automated way, right? An autonomous automated way, still with a safety kick out. If they sense you're saying something, they will need to kick out to a real human being, but you're going to get way more leverage out of that. So solving the staffing crisis is really where we see a lot of the big ideas, and we're going in and solving some of those things. Because it, you know, how are you going to get 30% more nurses overnight? Like you're going to grow them from scratch. Like, I mean, you know, like they're going to take years and years and years and years to do it. So that's kind of one aspect of it. Then there's a third idea, and we call this super staffing. In fact, this is the idea that I think I'm most excited about. And it says, hey, let's not just try to fill the staffing level, get, you know, fill the gap to get to the level we think is the right level. A large language model speaking at 100 words per minute will cost somewhere around 18 cents an hour. Okay, for the LLM, plus what's the ASR cost, the automatic speech recognition cost, the text-to-speech cost, the TTS cost. We kind of put it all in there. We're like, this is 18 cents an hour, maybe a little cheaper even. You know, if we get new inference chips, it'll get even cheaper. Like, there's all kinds of interesting things that go there, but it's almost zero already, right? And that's how you should think about it. What are the things in healthcare we don't do that we would do if it was zero? So do we call every patient 2 days after they start every new medication to see if they're having any side effects and then quickly try to change their dose or change the medication if they are? Because what we don't want is for them to have a really bad experience and, oh, that thing made me throw up all day, so I just stopped taking it. Because that's really what happens most of the time. And so I talked to the head of a pharmacy who's one of our partners, and I said, you know, what would you do? Do you call? And they're like, no, we don't call. I'm like, why don't you call them? There's not enough pharmacists even to do the stuff we have to do, let alone something like that. And we don't make enough money per you know, pill bottle to ever justify making a phone call to check in on your side effects. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, would that lead to better care? Yeah, would lead to better care. That they'd like lead to better retention for that pharmacy? Yep, better retention. I'm like, great, why don't we do that? Here's another example. There's 68 million Americans that have two or more chronic diseases. Today, only the top 1-3% get chronic care nurses that call them up. Chronic care nurses don't do diagnoses. They just call up and say, hey, did you take your medications today? Do you need more refills? Did you make an appointment for your follow-up? Do you need a ride to your follow-up? Like, they're just helping you manage your disease. They're care managers in a sense. And so, but why don't we have 68 million chronic care nurses? Because we can't afford to. At $90 an hour, your average cost of a nurse in most areas of the country, like there's no way it's actually ROI negative. Because you know what? That uncontrolled diabetes might be bad, but it's not going to kill you tomorrow. The system actually won't save money for years and years and years intervening, but it'll pay the cost today. So, you know, most people also don't know this. They're like, oh, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I'm like, nah. Problem is time. It turns out the average person in the U.S. changes healthcare plans every 3 years because they change jobs every 3 years. And so the healthcare plan will bear the cost to do the prevention, but won't basically the benefit, because actually most of the benefit will accrue to Medicare once you're over 65. And so, look, we believe there's a huge ROI in doing what we call super staffing, massively overstaffing the system in a way we've never done it before.
Yep.
And that's the big idea here. That's what we should use LLMs for.
Fascinating. So as you build the product, are you thinking or are you building a co-pilot kind of experience for the staffers, or are you eventually also creating those super staffers as independent AIs that will be disconnected from any kind of human?
We think all of the leverage only comes from creating kind of the automated bot, but with the right kick out. But I don't know that we won't do a transitional strategy with a co-pilot, but I think of the co-pilot as different. There's co-pilot where you're helping the nurse, right? And telling her, hey, say this, say that, do this, do that. Then there's co-pilot that's like a three-way call. Why don't we just have it on the line? And when the nurse talks to the patient and says, hey, do you need a ride to your appointment next week? Oh yeah, I do. I don't have a way to get there. Well, which is a major barrier of access for healthcare in the country. And so, great. Then the LLM pipes up. Maybe the LLM was introduced at the beginning. The nurse introduced the LLM, said, hey, here's my LLM, Rachel. Or, you know, if you want to say it that way, here's my virtual assistant, Rachel. She's here on the line. Rachel goes, hi, how are you? I'm here to help out with anything. And then while we're talking, oh, you need a ride? And Rachel pipes up and goes, hey, you need a ride? You know what? Why don't you guys keep talking? I'll call a bunch of transportation providers right now and see if I can get you a ride. And then 2 minutes later, because she could parallel dial five of them, right? And she comes back and says, hey, I found one. If they can't pick you up at 2, they can pick you up at 1:30. Is that all right? Oh, yes, it is. Okay, let me let them know. All right, bye.
Great.
Like, and then Rachel can call on her own the second time. Hey, you remember me? You talked to me already. Right? The nurse asked me to call you and just see how you're doing. And anything you tell me, I'll tell to the nurse. Don't worry. Like, there's a very, I think what we have a transition problem. I don't think we ultimately have a conversation problem. These LLMs are very conversant. Mm-hmm. They can even do things that, think about it. Like today, everybody's like, hey, when I talk to when I'm engaging with patients, I don't get good engagement. I'm like, yeah, because you call them, nag them to take their meds and hang up. Right? When you run a call center, what's your number one criteria? Average handle time. Right? Like, get in, get out. But what builds relationships? Talking to people. What drives empathy? Then, by the way, the number one driver of whether you thought you had an empathetic doctor was, did they not cut you off when you started telling your story? And man, do people love telling their story. Well, there I was skiing and it was a cloudy day and I had a new pair of skis. And I mean, then they give a lot of detail that, you know, the doctor's sitting there going, this is irrelevant. I don't really need these details. But in that detail is the relationship building. Well, at 18 cents an hour, why don't we let it talk to you for a half an hour about anything, right? Oh, I was in this battle in Desert Storm and that's when I injured my knee originally. And now I'm in rehab for it again. And, you know, oh yeah, that battle. I mean, this thing's read every page of Wikipedia, probably knows every major battle. Mm-hmm. Like there is a whole new paradigm here that can be deployed. And I think people haven't even begun to realize what happens when the incremental cost goes to zero, and you have infinite capacity and infinite time, yeah, and really infinite attention. What's his name? The author of Sapiens, Harari.
Yes.
Was being interviewed by Lex Fridman. And he said something so interesting. They're like, are you worried about AI taking over the world? And I'm going to paraphrase him. And he said, no, I'm not worried about the maniacal AI of like this, you know, Terminator or Matrix sort of thing. He says, I'm more worried about the fact that the AI is so seductive because it gives you undivided attention. And nowhere else in life do we get undivided attention. And I thought about that when he said that. And I was like, oh my God, he's so right. Like we never get undivided attention. And now in the iPhone world, like you really can't even like be at a dinner table and get undivided attention when you're having dinner with friends. And but undivided attention is incredibly seductive, mm-hmm, and incredibly, you know, like people want it badly. And so I think that there's some really interesting new conversational paradigms to be had. I mean, by the way, there's a real technical issue here.
Yeah.
Go look at the Llama 2 paper. Go look at the instruction tuning they did. What you'll notice, the average number of instructions they have like 7 data sets they showed for their instruction tuning. The average number of instructions, 1. Mm-hmm. They made their own, that's 3.9. What's the average back and forth conversation in a voice-based thing going to be? Like 40, 100?
Yeah.
Nobody's instruction tuned for that. They've all instruction tuned for what I call a query, not a conversation. A query is like, I put in ChatGPT, I get an answer, I modify it slightly, I put it in, I get an answer. And they're long-winded answers. I mean, they should have never called it ChatGPT. They should have called it BlogGPT because it's super long-winded. And you can't even get it to be short-winded. You can actually, like, you can try to prompt it and be like, please be short when, you know, please say this concisely. And it'll just give you this, or say it in one sentence. It'll like, try it. It'll give you like a five line run on sentence. Like, it's crazy. And I think you need a whole new conversational paradigm. You need to instruction tune these models very differently to have this paradigm. In voice, you do things you don't do. We repeat words again and again. We say incomplete sentences. We give a lot of active listening clues. And those are really important. And so, oh, that's too bad. Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, when you're telling your story of your woes around your health, you need these little affordances and clues. And that's what we figured out is this is a different model that needs to be built. And so that's why we're building our own model and we're building it from scratch.
Yeah, so I'd love to dive into this part of the conversation about the model itself. It's presented as a state-of-the-art model that has outperformed GPT-4 on 105 out of the 114 healthcare exams and certifications. So I'd love to maybe start with that bit, talk about that process, and then you know, after that we can get into the more technical details. But like, maybe walk us through that certification process and how that worked and anything that you learned there.
So we're building multiple versions of our model. The first version we built was, hey, let's just teach it to pass every medical certification we could find. So we literally went on, we found every last, like the board licensing exam for OBGYNs, the geriatric nurse certification exam, the ICU nurse certification exam, the NAPLEX for pharmacists, that's the main test that pharmacists take, the NCLEX for nurses, like we just found everything. And then we took it. And then we had GPT-4 take it, and we had all the other language models take it, and we beat them all. And we beat them on 105 of 114 for GPT-4, for example. And so what we did is we proved that, hey, if you focus on a vertical, you can make a thing that can take tests better. I'm not going to overstate it. I don't think you built a better healthcare LLM yet, because you really just built a version that they could take tests better, but it's a start. And it wasn't that hard to do, which actually is a good thing because you were like, hey, you know what? There's a big gap here. By the way, one of the reasons I think there's a big gap is healthcare data is very different than other data. Imagine an iceberg floating in the water and everything below the line is stuff that's behind a firewall and everything above the water line is on the internet. Healthcare looks like an iceberg, right? Thanks to HIPAA, most of the data is below the water line. Travel is like an iceberg flipped upside down. Yep. Most of the content's on the internet. And so whenever people are like, and math is that way too. Like whenever people are like, and I think coding is that way too because of GitHub, like people are like, oh, horizontal LLMs are much better than vertical LLMs. I'm like, when most of the content's on the internet. Otherwise, how the heck, you know, like it hasn't even seen content. So we've done some really interesting things on building our language model from scratch. To focus on this. We've instruction tuned it better, as I talked about before. We've actually gone in and acquired 1.5 trillion healthcare tokens.
Maybe let's dive into that. Yeah. So, you know,
that's how you build a better thing. So,
yes.
So the first version took tests better. Second version we're now building is designed to outperform. It's better. It's instruction tuned differently. It's fundamentally pre-trained differently on healthcare content we got. We actually just announced 10 health systems that partnered with us and they're going to be helping us to make it safe and working with us to ensure. So that's part of it. We then continue to, we're doing RLHF differently. We're actually using healthcare professionals to do the RLHF, which we can talk about when we talk about safety a little bit later.
Meaning but, this to double click, meaning that you have a dietitian, a psychiatrist, or like whoever that sits down and
play. Whatever the role it's supposed to play, we're getting, exactly.
And then they give a like or a thumbs up or thumbs down to the answer. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we've just gone through, so as we're building the model, as we're building the next generation of our model, we basically said, pre-train it better. We're setting up the embedding space differently. We're tokenizing differently. Think of healthcare words. Think of drug names. Drug names are not real words. They're completely made up. They're not the sum of their tokens, right? You know, like they're just a completely made up word. And so we said, oh my God, you have to treat these differently. How do you treat these differently? That's what we figured out.
We
most of the other domains don't have their own dialect. Healthcare has its own dialect. It's its own thing. It needs its own vocabulary. So that's part of what we've been able to do. So that's us now working on building that version of the model. We'll then take it and further launch not only an API that other people can use to build, but we'll launch specific roles. We'll say, okay, here is our chronic care nurse. We've now instruction tuned it for every single thing a chronic care nurse would do. Because most people keep thinking an LLM is an application. It's not. It's a rough draft engine, right? Like it's better to think of it like an OS. Somebody's got to build Excel on top of it. And that's kind of our view is that, I mean, some health systems out there, some insurance companies can probably take an API from us and build something. But most don't. Most need an application. They need to buy an application. And so we've come to realize, you know, that most of the health systems in the US are going to need a ready, finished product / application, not just have an API.
Yep. Can you talk to the 80% of the iceberg that you mentioned a minute ago and around data acquisition strategies? And I mean, to the extent that there's stuff that you cannot talk about, maybe talk about it indirectly for anyone that might be listening to this, that thinking about building a vertical LLM. How do people, you just go around and strike partnerships, you pay for the data, how does it all work?
Look, I think the acquisition of training data is one of the most proprietary elements, so we don't really talk about a lot of it. But I would just say, I'll give you like one example. If you're training an LLM, you do need to go and figure out what data, a healthcare LLM needs a broad set of data. And you need to go and figure out where that data is and what it might be useful for. For example, how can you have an LLM that might be asked to function as a dietitian and not know the menu of every restaurant in the country? Mm-hmm. Right?
Interesting. And so not all data is health data.
Well, the menu of every restaurant in the country is certainly health data by my definition.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, because what does a person really want in their healthcare dietitian? They don't want a dietitian that educates you on how to eat. Like nobody wanted that even ever. What they want is here, I'm at this restaurant. These are the medications that I'm on. These are the procedures I've had done. This is my health situation. What should I not order? Or what three choices should I make? And what ingredients should I tell them to take out? Well, that's what you want, right? Well, guess what? That world is here, but it's not so easy to get. You have to kind of go and get it. Some of it's in the common crawl. Some of it's not in the common crawl. A lot of it's been done digitally, at least, thanks to DoorDash. And, you know, things are out there, but you really do have to find and think through content like that and say, what content is necessary and available that will enhance my language model, my healthcare language model's ability to do its full job. We've actually taken the time to go and get every single 200-page PDF of every healthcare plan in the country. You need to know what's covered, not covered. It should have read all that. But you're like, oh, it's on the internet. No, it's not all on the internet. Like, if this isn't, it's not hard to get, but you got to go get it. And there's a lot. think somebody on our team was just telling me that it was like 68,000 from one carrier alone the other day that we got of these documents. I was like, oh my God. So there's just, you know, again, how could you have a language model that doesn't know what insurance covers? Like, in fact, you would be so much happier if your doctor knew what every single plan covered and memorized it in his or her head. If they knew that every formulary, every drug cost, oh, you go to Walgreens, you know, I'm going to put you on this thing rather than this one because Walgreens' formulary under the Humana XYZ plan will have you paying this much copay versus you only pay this much on this deal. I mean, it should know all that. It doesn't. No doctor does, but that's part of the real opportunity. So we've really thought broadly, and there's just a ton of content that you just have to think through and really include. And that's part of what we're building.
Yep. So we talked about data acquisitions. We talked about RLHF. The model itself, did you guys start from open source or did you start from scratch?
We're starting from all sources. We've tried everything.
From open source? Yep.
We've tried, I mean, you don't just sit there and try it one way, right? You try it every single way. Yep. Every time a new one comes out, you try it. But I will tell you that we are finding that we're having to build almost everything from scratch to get it to work right.
No free lunch.
No. There's some benefits, some places you can use one piece for here or there. It's not clear the answer is one model either. It's different models for different things. Speed is a big issue if you're speaking over the phone.
Yeah.
You got to get the speed right. Voice synthesis. We're not doing our own ASR and TTS. We're leveraging other people's, but we are building our own tone classifiers and things like that to figure out, like, well, if I'm speaking to you, I should be able to tell the difference between my back hurts. And I should respond differently. Mm-hmm. And so we have built tone classifiers and things like that to be able to do features. So again, we just thought through the domain, right? And thought through the use case. Like, you wouldn't need a tone classifier for most interactions with an LLM, but you do in healthcare. Because a lot of the information is in the anger, the pain, the frustration. That's where you get a sense of how big a problem this is to the person. Yeah. Versus it's just, you know, a slight issue.
Yeah. How do you think about the hallucination problem, or, you know, more generally, the fact that AI is a predictive technology that, you know, gets it right like 90% of the time, you know, in a context where the outcomes can be pretty high?
Yeah, that's why I don't do diagnoses. Don't do diagnoses because the thing hallucinates and you're going to kill somebody. Like, I mean, I think it's like a very... So the number one way to deal with hallucinations is pick the right applications. If I build you a scheduling agent for scheduling your MRI and it hallucinates, you know what? Not the end of the world. Your appointment might get booked a little wrong. We'll fix it. Like, that'll get fixed at some point. Right. So pick the right applications on there. If it makes up a dish that's not at a restaurant when it's recommending something, like, okay, not the end of the world. So the right applications is one of the keys. Second, you know, actually the Llama paper showed something pretty interesting, right? Where you overtrain on your high quality sources. So since I've licensed some of the sources, I'm like, I know this is a good source. Don't massively overtrain on that source. That's exactly what they did. And they showed it brought down some of their hallucination rate. Great. That's what you do. And then there's other ways to kind of cross-check it and do it. But I look, the number one element of the hallucination elimination is some of these techniques. And you know, it is encouraging that GPT-4 was able to get a lower hallucination rate, even while the model got bigger than 3.5. And so my hope is that as we build bigger and bigger models, we will also see a naturally declining hallucination rate. But I think the scaling laws on that remain to be seen because not enough people have published hallucination rate by size above 70 billion parameters. Like, there isn't a lot of data that looks like that.
And as I understand that you're going to deploy this on a sort of B2B basis, working with healthcare systems, would you enable them to bring their own data through a vector database and they would connect with Hippocratic AI and Hippocratic AI, the LLM would be able to check against their data? Is that part of the idea or?
There might be some document retrieval solutions as well in there, but they're harder to make work than most people think. I mean, there's like this, oh, I can now just cross.
I think it's probably true of generative AI in general. It's a lot harder than people think.
You're much better off trying to train the core model to do it if you can, but, you know, we'll see.
Okay.
But there are some cases where they have their own data and they don't want it commingled and they don't want it the pre-training. And so then what do? You have to do something like what you just said. So we're working through some of that.
Go ahead.
That's okay. The nice thing about healthcare is a lot of stuff standardized.
Mm-hmm.
The care plan for dealing with certain health issues is put out by the board of cardiology for dealing with XYZ issue in your heart. And that is the standard of care for most places. But some places like a Mayo or a Cleveland Clinic will have their own very specific, better protocol that they've developed. But if you look at the 7,000 hospitals in the country, 6,900 will probably use the same protocol. So
let's talk about ethics and regulation a little bit. Obviously, a very key topic in the healthcare. You have made a very clear claim about being and sort of ethics first, I believe privacy first as well, model, I guess the name of the company itself. But can you maybe go into this, including that concept of also bedside manners that you sort of alluded to?
So first, we're safety first. That's what we're committed to. And inherent in that is some of the other things. I mean, they're just kind of like, you can't be safety first without doing some of the other things you mentioned. But I have some, so there's a lot of talk about regulating AI. And the question is, what's the best, like regulating to what end? Well, regulating to make it safe, right? That's our primary goal, at least in healthcare. What's the best way to do that? Is it a bunch of top-down rules? Maybe. I'm open to it. I think it might be necessary. I think we should have that conversation. We should work on those answers. But I think there's an even better answer. I call it bottoms-up regulation. Tell me why. Like, if I told you, hey, this, you have two choices. You can use LLMA or LLMB. LLMA follows this standard thing put out by, you know, some governmental body that says it'll make it safe. As long as it follows these rules. LLMB had 1,000 chronic care nurses QA the chronic care nurse functionality and was only released, and they gave it RLHF feedback, and then it was only released when a majority of them said it was safe in a blind taste test where they didn't know it was human or not. I'd go with B. Now, the best is both, which is better. And we'll do, I think that's probably the right answer. But everybody's been talking about A. I've almost heard nobody talk about bottoms up. Like, why aren't we using the experts who do the job today, who know the job best, as our way of determining safety? It seems so like obvious to me. It's like, we weren't even that smart in coming up with it. It's a pretty obvious idea, but it feels so much more right. Like, I would want 1,000 genetic counselors telling me my genetic counselor is safe. Like, who better to judge the safety of a language model than the medical practitioners who do it today? And so that's our approach. And so, and in all those other areas, look, I think we're all trying our darndest to do the right thing to get ahead of the technology, but, you know, we're all still trying to forecast what something will be when we don't yet know, right? So I think it'll all, like, we'll have to learn and adapt along the way. Like, nobody has the prescience to see it all up front. And even some of the dangers of prior technologies, like, okay, if I had sat you down in 2000, and when did Facebook launch? I don't know, 2004, five?
Or something like that, yeah.
Something like that, right? And I'd say, okay, let's think it through all the regulation we could do for this platform. Would you have said, hey, I'm worried about election interference, no matter how much thinking we all did in a room together? No, I mean, nobody could say that, right? Like, it was a downstream implication. We couldn't have even, like, so many things had to happen for us to even realize that. And I think that, I think that we have some of this will emerge. We're just going to have to be responsible actors that are constantly looking and trying to address it quickly. And that's what we're doing. I mean, you know, I named the company Hippocratic for a reason. I made the tagline, do no harm. Like, I don't know what greater way to say we're going to try our darndest than the name and the darn tagline. But I think that it's still going to be a process. Like, there's a lot of things we don't know yet that will happen. And we're just going to have to do it. And that's why we're partnering with the health systems first. We did not just release this. We did not just build it and then take it to them. We are literally having them work with us, you know, in joint development sessions every minute. And we believe they understand better than anybody how to deliver healthcare safely. And so that's what we're doing. But we are doing it in a vertical.
Yeah. You know, I heard you say somewhere that you don't have a precise release date. The release date is when it's good enough to be released, given the importance of it.
You can't say it's safety first and have a release date. Because then that means you'll release when you hit the date, because you promised a bunch of guys that you'll release it rather than releasing it when it's safe. And so I'm like, look, we'll release it when it's safe. I mean, or when they tell us it's safe, really. And by they, I mean both their managerial teams, but really, I mean their bottoms up teams. You know, when all the nurses at that health system say this is safe, then great, safe.
In a world where everybody's imagination has been caught by ChatGPT, are you finding that the healthcare regulators, broadly speaking, are excited by AI, scared about AI? Are they knowledgeable about it? Do you have an opportunity to engage in constructive conversations? What's the general vibe, I guess, for lack of a better term?
I think it's... my observation so far is they're on it. They're focused on it. They're thinking about it. But rightfully so, from what I've seen, they're far more on it for diagnoses. Right? I mean, almost all your AI regulation to date from the FDA has been on diagnostic products. You know, again, yet another reason not to do diagnoses, because there is going to be regulation and it is going to be important. And that probably should be slower. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think there's, you know, there are areas where we can add value and we can change healthcare and we can lead to better outcomes, and we should do those. And there's areas that are just going to take more regulation, need to go slower. We need to maybe even have advances in core model development to take hallucination rates much lower, like, you know, before we utilize it for that. And I think people have to just accept that, you know, there are better and worse applications for each technology, even within a vertical.
Great. So as one of the people building one of those, you know, that new species of generative AI companies, any early lesson learned just about, you know, anything, but like one aspect that would be interesting is like, how do you build a team to do something like this? Do you have mostly engineers? Do they all need to be, you know, super PhDs in AIs? You know, how many people do you have like on the data acquisition front? Like, what does the overall sort of structure of the company look like? And what have you learned there?
Yeah. Look, AI is about having a few people with really amazing breakthroughs. Engineering concepts make a very big difference. Like, it's not a volume game. It is really a talent game of, you want kind of the most talented folks. And that's been our hiring strategy to a large extent. Like, we just have some of the smartest folks you've ever seen, because it doesn't take a lot of people to build an LLM company. It just takes like a very specific level of ability, intellect, and skill. And so we have very much focused on that. I mean, we got deluged after we launched. We got some like 4,000 or 5,000 engineering resumes submitted to us. Like, it was insane. I had to hire 3 full-time recruiters just to go through them all and set up screening calls and go through and kind of figure it out. Actually, 4, I think, at some point we had. And just very talented people. But, you know, And then we hired a subset of them, and we hired folks from some of the best places out there. You know, I think we have like 11 people from Stanford, and we have like 4 people from Berkeley, and we have 5 people from IIT, and we have, you know, just a host of very, very talented folks. But that's what it looks like. And it's mostly all engineering, but ours is a weird mix. If you come into our company, you'll be like, wow, there's a whole bunch of NLP, machine learning, generative AI, and general integration folks, you know, as well, because we also have to integrate with health systems, IT systems. And so we have kind of two teams. We have our engineering team that's doing all the integrations. We have our LLM team that's building the LLM. And then we have a group of clinicians. So we have 2 doctors full-time. We have 2 full-time nurses on staff, all giving constant, actually 3 doctors on staff, giving constant feedback to the LLM and giving constant domain expertise. So you do have this kind of duality of you need both types of expertise, and we have it. And so, but you really have to, we are doing something different. We're 100% in person. Our company is literally 5 days a week, like this pandemic remote work experiment. I don't know. I'm like, it was an experiment. I think startups that move really fast and need to move fast are better off in person. And so, you know, we've been, and it's been fun. Honestly, it's been really fun. You come into our office, you could like hear people talking. It's like, there's a buzz where everybody's heads down, kind of cranking. We, you know, we have lunch brought in, we have happy hour on Thursdays. Like I forgot, like, I don't know about you, but like, you know, my last company, we worked from home starting the pandemic and then never came back.
Yeah.
And it is so much more energizing. It's so much more fun. I think the younger folks are getting way better mentorship than they're ever getting in a remote environment. And I think our collaboration is so much faster. Our time to respond. You can just grab somebody on the shoulder, tap them on the shoulder and get an answer in 10 seconds. Then, you know, in remote work, everything's a 30-minute minimum Zoom block. Right? Like, it didn't even need to be. You're like, why is my calendar totally full? So it's been a joy, honestly, just having such a talented team and having them all in one place, just all with a fixed mission, and having kind of the, like, no engineer in our team that are trying to decide, you know, it's the LM say it that way or that way, like, boom. There's a nurse sitting right there, and they're like, "Does this seem right to you?" Like, we just have like instant feedback because of how we've structured the team. And then you do have people on the content team acquiring content, and that's another whole exercise that seems to never end. Like, there's never ending amount of content. Just when you think you've thought of all the places there could be healthcare content, you do a brainstorm and you come up with like 200 more. like there's a lot of deep content in places nobody even realizes.
Awesome. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation and such an interesting area and such a gigantic opportunity. So I'm personally very excited to see you guys progress over the next few months and see the product when it comes out and all the things. So I want to say first and foremost a major thank you for spending time with us, sharing your thoughts and your experience, your lessons learned, and I very much hope that you'll come back when the product is out and you know, out in the wild and with you know, what you're saying and how things are progressing. So thank you so much. Really enjoyed it. Appreciate it, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Awesome. Take care.
Thanks for joining us for the MAD Podcast. We're back here every Wednesday with new conversations with leaders in the machine learning, AI, and data space. And if you like this show, you can also find the video recording of not only this episode, but many, many more over on the Data Driven NYC YouTube channel. Thanks again, and catch you next week.